Parshas Mishpatim continues to unfold with entirely new issues and subjects every two or three verses. And we're going to take a look at a verse in which there's two entirely different ideas in one verse. I'm going to direct you to the end of Chamishi, the very end of the fifth reading, chapter 23, verse 19. It's the last verse of today's reading, of today's shir, allotment. And it starts off, the pasuk, the same verse, starts off talking about agriculture. And then we end up discussing prohibited proteins in the kitchen. Reishis bikurei admoscha. The Torah says the firstling, the first of your firstling fruit. The word bikurei comes from the word bechor, which means firstborn. Of your land, tovi beis Hashem alikecha. This has to be brought to the house of your God, which is a euphemistic reference to the beis hamikdash. You shall not cook a young animal in his mother's milk. Okay. So since we're going to learn at least one pasuk today, the focus is going to be the second half of the pasuk, but I got to learn a pasuk. So let's take a look at the pasuk from the top. Reishis bikurei admoscha. This is not the pasuk that speaks about bikurim, the first thing fruit. In fact, we discussed that already, and we'll discuss it later. So what is the Torah adding here? It says, Rashi, Af hashvi is chayeves bebikurim. The seventh year, when we do not work the field, the orchard, and the plantation. The year in which all of the land of Israel is left fallow. Nonetheless, if you are the proverbial owner, I say only proverbial because in the seventh year there is no owner. It's available for everybody. But if you are the owner, you were in the sixth year, you will be in the eighth year, so you're kind of the owner now too, so the firstling fruits nonetheless have to be brought to Yerushalayim, to the Beis HaMikdash. L'kach nemar, that's why the commandment of Bikurim is mentioned here, Afkan. Even though we're going to mention this later in chapter 34 of Exodus, and much later in the book of Deuteronomy, it will be mentioned in great detail. And even though the year of Shemitah is exempt from Terumah and Maaser, from the special foods that are given to the Kohen. So despite all of this, Bikurei Admoscha is still applicable. Now Rashi says, okay, so what is Bikurei Admoscha? Because we haven't really discussed it yet. So Rashi says, he gives you, fills you with now, he says, Adam nichnas l'teich sadeu. A person saunters into his field. And this is just when the fruits are beginning to blossom and develop. Veroya te'eino shebikra. He sees a fig, for example, that has now begun to reach maturation. So the blossoms are falling off, a bulb has emerged, a fruit is starting to take shape, take root, and mature. So Kodech Alav Gemi, he kind of ties a small piece of grass or some kind of rubber onto it, and he does this, Lesimon, that's a sign. Umakdisha, and he sanctifies it. Rashi doesn't talk about it here, but the Rambam is very explicit in Sefer HaMitzvot, as well as in Mishnah Torah, and he says, the makdisha, the sanctification, has to take place in a verbal way. He says, Harei ze bikurim. Because we know generally when it comes to making things holy, you have to use your words. So here also, makdisha means that he uses his words, so to speak, and he says, this is bikurim. And then after this fruit continues to grow and reaches full maturation, so then it's set aside and it will be brought to Yerushalayim as a special gift to Hashem, and it gets eaten by the Kohanim. Rashi says, "Ve'ein bikurim ele m'sheva minim." The special firstling fruits are only brought from the seven kinds, ha'amurim b'mikra, which are enumerated in the eighth chapter of Deuteronomy. Eretz, a land of chita usa'ira, a land of wheat and barley, and the pasuk goes on to say, gefen and te'ena, grape and fig, rima and pomegranate. Eretz, a land of zeis shemen, a land of olives, and a land of dvash, of dates. Which these are the peiros shenishtabchu behen Eretz Yisrael. These are the proverbial fruits with which the land of Israel is praised. So why does it say reishis bikurei? It's like almost a double redundancy, which is also a double redundancy. right? It's double and redundant. Reishis Bikurei. Bikurei means first. So the Sefarno says, because even when it comes to the Bikurim, we select the finest of the first. Not all the first, but the finest. So the best of the best. The finest of the finest, the first of the first. And then the Pasuk goes on and talks to us about that we move from here into the non-kosher kitchen. Now, what is the connection between Bikurim and between the prohibition of milk and meat, which you're going to talk about now? It's the connection. It's like, it seems to have really nothing to do with one another. And if they were in separate verses, you couldn't ask the question. All right, they're in separate verses. It's in the same verse, for heaven's sake. Why did Hashem put it in the same verse in the Torah? So the Or HaChaim says, this is because the prohibition of milk and meat are unique. Typically, kosher food is not about the kitchen, meaning it's not about cooking. It's about consumption. It's about eating. So people who have kosher kitchens, but they eat out, are not really keeping kosher. Right? As one wise woman once told my wife, I realized my dishes will go to heaven, and I won't. So I started keeping kosher. Keeping kosher is a diet. Obviously, you have to have a kosher kitchen to be able to eat kosher. But it's not about the pots and pans. It's not about flatware or cutlery. It's about the food you eat. And here we're getting a business of leisavashel. You shouldn't cook. But there's something unique about this prohibition. It's not only prohibited from consumption, it's also prohibited from benefit. I'm not allowed to benefit in any way, shape, or form. So milk and meat used to feed my dog is a problem too. I'm benefiting from it. Nathan, you can't come late and then like have these questions about my dog. Like,
I just heard of the time feed your dog.
I've been talking about my dog for 10 minutes now. Now you show up.
Want to walk my dog?
No. But should you have milk and meat, you can't even feed it to your dog. And not because your dog had a bar mitzvah last year. But because that would be, you're benefiting from it, and you're responsible for paying for its food. The Rabbeinu Bechaya quotes the Medrash, and he says that the idea of cooking in the kitchen represents also things maturing in their place in the tree or in the ground. So it's like we actually refer to the maturation of fruit with the terminology of bishul, which is pretty unusual, because in Hebrew, just about every activity has a word for itself. There's a different Hebrew word for harvesting grapes and a different Hebrew word for harvesting olives, because it's a different process. It's actually a different word. So if there's different words for everything, how is it that when it comes to the maturation of a fruit and when it comes to cooking in the kitchen, we actually use the same word? One is God's kitchen, God's cooking, helping it reach perfection, and then Hashem allows you to make things go perfect in your kitchen. So there's a similar terminology. And Rabbeinu Bechaya says that this is therefore the same idea. It's to tell you that Bikurim, even though it's supposed to be firstling fruit, wait till it's fully baked, so to speak. Wait till it's cooked, meaning after it's mature. You bring mature fruits, not firstling fruits. Don't pluck off the first time the fruit appears. Oh, firstling fruit, pluck it off. You wait till it matures. And that's, as Rashi told us, well, you have to identify it, you have to verbalize, you have to set it aside, and then later you bring it to the Beis HaMikdash. All right, very good. Let's move on to the second half of the verse. So the second half of the verse tells us, "Leisavashel gedi b'chaleivimay." Rashi says this does not talk about a gedi, which usually might refer to a kid, a goat kid, or a small goat, but rather this refers to every kind of kosher animal, and there aren't that many kinds, by the way. But the kosher animals, the behema, not chaya, not the wild undomesticated animal, the kosher animals. So the kosher animals are af egel, v'cheves, b'chlal gedi. The small calf and the small sheep is also included in this prohibition. She'en gedi, el eloshen volod rach. The word gedi, which I suppose would be translated as a kid, the kid means a small animal. A small, delicate animal. So whether it's a small, delicate cow, it's a small, delicate sheep, or a small, delicate goat, so all these things would be considered to be a kid. And mimasha ata moitza bekama mekemis b'teira. You find the numerous references or mentions in the Torah of the word gedi. And when it says it's a kid goat, it says gedi izim. Hutzrich lafarash acharav izim. But if kid meant a goat, why would you have to say a kid goat? You just say a kid, and you know it means a goat. But the fact that the Torah, which doesn't use any additional words when unnecessary, tells you a kid goat, a gdi izim, that tells you that the kid in and of itself is not necessarily a goat, but rather would refer to any young animal, a suckling animal. For example, Kigoyin, with Yehuda sending a message to Tamar, Anoichi ashalach gdi izim, I'm going to send kid goats. Or, in that same story, Eskedi ha'izim, the small kid goats. Shnei gedoye izim, two small kid goats. And l'lamedcha, this all comes to teach you. Shebechal makim shenemar gedi, whenever it says the word gedi, without saying gedi izim, that it doesn't refer to a goat, but rather refers to a small animal. Af ega v'cheves b'mashma, that includes the cow and the sheep. U'b'shleishim b'koymis nichtav v'teira, that three times says in the Torah, the idea of leisavashal gedi b'chalevimei, and Rashi says, it comes to teach you about three unique prohibitions. After all, why repeat the same thing three times if it's saying exactly the same thing? And they are le'isr achila, the prohibition of consumption; le'isr hanah, echad le'isr hanah, one is for the prohibition of benefit, as we mentioned; and lastly, the echad le'isr bishol, as the Rebbe once explained. So, why does Rashi have to talk about that here? He should talk about that after the second or third time. This is the first time. There's no question here yet, right? But his answer is very simple. He says, well, if you talk about keeping kosher, when people hear the word kosher, what activity do they think of? Cooking? Feeding the dog? Or eating? What do we refer to usually? Eating, not cooking. There's no mitzvah. It's not a cooking mitzvah. It's an eating mitzvah. Obviously, you have to cook kosher in order to eat kosher. Why would you cook not kosher? But really and truly, if a person cooks non-kosher food, he's not doing a sin per se. If you're working in a non-kosher establishment, as long as you're not cooking milk and meat, you can make bacon and eggs, just don't eat it. Now, obviously, this is a problem. If people are going to cook bacon and eggs, they might end up eating it, so there's rabbinic limitations and restrictions. But principally, the idea of eating bacon and eggs is the problem, not the idea of owning bacon and eggs or cooking bacon and eggs. When it comes, however, to the milk and meat, the Torah begins by telling us, doesn't say don't eat milk and meat, don't consume milk and meat, it says don't cook milk and meat. That's very unusual. So therefore, Rashi feels compelled to tell you that actually this is going to be the same thing, not once, not twice, but three times. And this is because the Torah prohibits not only the consumption, not only the benefit, but even the idea of the cooking. Now, the Sefer HaChinuch emphasizes that there are certain material in Torah which we consider to be off limits. It's not kosher. The pig, for example, it's not kosher. And then there are things in the Torah which are perfectly kosher. And that is the cow's milk is perfectly kosher, or the goat's milk, or the sheep's perfectly kosher. And the meat, perfectly kosher. The problem when these two perfectly kosher items are perfectly blended, that's when we have a problem. So, in other words, it's a unique kind of prohibition because you're creating the prohibition. Whereas in the other examples, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, this is off limits for you. Here it's a human disaster. It's a man-made problem. You took things which were permissible, you created prohibited prohibited mixture, which ultimately is like a spiritual combustion. So it's the mixing that's the issue over here, and that's why there's an emphasis on le'sevashel gedi b'chalevime, because the way you really mix the two is when you cook. When they're cold, they're not really mixing. When you cook, because of the nature of heat, that opens the pores, it changes the molecular structure, and the two come together as one. So why can't we eat milk and meat? Many of the Rishonim labored to give understanding and reasons for this. For example, Rabbeinu Bechaya says that milk is on some level made of blood. The blood turns into milk. That's what the body of the animal or the person for that matter is. The blood turns into milk. And therefore, when you cook milk with meat, what happens to the milk? It goes right back to blood. And he said because it goes back to blood, the nature of blood is that it's mitamtem es halev. It seals the heart. It takes away our human sensitivity. Because typically, when we ingest something foreign, there's a long process from ingestion to the actual injection into the bloodstream. We have very sophisticated machinery, which apparently the Kishkas can react on this building that's so long. They're very, very long, and there's a lot going on in your stomach. Hashem created a really miraculous machine. And it's designed to be able to ingest, to chop up, to puree, and to work through, to the point that you separate the toxins and the good stuff. Eventually, the negative things which can harm you will be broken down and pushed out of your body, and the little bit of goodness will be taken out, cleansed through the liver, and then injected into the bloodstream. What's the one exception?
Blood itself.
When you consume blood, it goes straight into the bloodstream. In other words, what's coursing through your veins? The animal blood. So there's always a danger of becoming what you eat. We're supposed to elevate what we eat, so we turn the animal into human. But here, when that's what's firing your life, when that's what's giving you life, that's your blood, then basically you have an animal and animalistic tendencies flowing through your veins. And that, he says, is a disaster. That destroys the human spirit. That's the meaning of a tamtam esalev. So that's Rabbeinu Bechai's approach. It's not different from Rabbeinu Bechai's explanation of blood. And he explains, when you cook milk and meat, you turn the milk into blood, and therefore you destroy the human spirit. Rambam in Merid Avuchim says that this used to be the archetypal meal eaten by the idolaters. This was like almost a flagship kind of meal. This is what the idolaters did. And we could discuss that as to why, but this is the matter of fact. And Rambam says we have to distance ourselves from the behavior of the idolaters. And since this was the idolatrous practice, that's why the Torah rules it out entirely for the members of Am Yisrael. Ibn Ezra says that this is about cruelty. There's a certain cruelty in taking a kid and cooking it in his mother's milk. And because it would be impossible to know which is the mother's milk, which is the other mother's milk, and because it gets all confused, so therefore Ibn Ezra says it's an act of cruelty, and acts of cruelty, as the Sefer HaChinuch says, make you cruel. And therefore the Torah says it has to be avoided at any cost. And this is elaborated on in great detail. Somebody once pointed me to an article written about a movie by Steven Spielberg named Munich. Steven Spielberg is known for these images you create, like the little girl in the colored coat, that everything is black and white, everybody talks about from Schindler's List. So apparently in Munich, when he wants to give this very, very graphic representation of, you know, the struggle between Israel and its enemies, so he has I think that the danae of this movie is that the Shin Bet goes after the people, the Munich monsters, and eliminates them one at a time. So the first assassination of this monster, the first monster is killed eating cereal or something like that, and the blood mixes with the milk. And that's like death, life and death, because milk is where life comes from, and blood represents death, bloodletting. And that's, I'm just like using that as a frame, but this is a kind of like an example of how it represents the concept of life and death being mixed together, and ultimately is about cruelty. And the approach of the Ibn Ezra is probably the most common approach in the Rishonim and Achronim. The Rebbe actually talks about the Ibn Ezra, and he kind of follows along with that. Which brings us to the subject of today's question. Why are we giving reasons? Why are we giving reasons? Isn't this a chok? Isn't this like one of those things that the Torah says, and that's why you do it? And by extension, let me ask you another question. Parshas Mishpatim means what? The parsha of laws, ordinances. There are three kinds of mitzvahs. There are mitzvahs that are called chukim, the mitzvahs we don't understand. Perhaps the archetypal mitzvah is the ashes of the red heifer, which makes some people pure and other people impure. So what is it? Is it an agent of purity or an agent of impurity? They say, well, it's an agent. It depends on the circumstances. That doesn't make any sense. If you tell me that somebody works hard cleaning the floor and he ends up dirty, that makes sense. You expend energy cleaning something, you get dirty yourself. I get that. But imagine here, you have two people touching the same substance. One becomes pure, one becomes impure. Make up your mind. This is either Mr. Clean or it's Mr. Dirty. What is it? It's either detergent or it's filth. So that's the archetypal example of Parah Aduma. And even Shlomo HaMelech, who understood Sugizunt, all the reasons of mitzvahs, even Shlomo HaMelech couldn't understand this one. But there are many examples of chukim, and usually the idea of not eating milk and meat is considered to be in the level or realm of a chok. That's the way it is. That's what God said. There are mitzvahs that are called testimonial, and they're not really that hard to understand. Every civilization has its practices that bring to mind some kind of historicity, something that was important, that happened, that enables the country to maintain its culture or its civilization. So they go through certain mechanisms and eat certain food, do certain things, wear certain clothes, whether the Scotsman's kilt or the Bavarian's wurst, I don't know, whatever it is. People have shtick. Okay, so they have shticks. We have shtick too. It's not like, so, I can't believe it. You guys eat crackers? So yeah, why do you do that? Because we left Mitzrayim, a dough baked. Oh, all right, fine. I guess it's one of your national favorite foods. He says, you Jews are funny, man. Our national foods taste really good. Like, this is your food? Okay, fine. So you don't like our national food. We don't maybe like it either. It doesn't make a difference. It's not so hard to understand it. But then we have a mitzvah that doesn't make any sense to us. It's called a chok. It's a statute. Parshas Mishpatim, we have chukim, edut, and mishpatim. Mishpatim are the mitzvahs that are rhyme and reason. Parshas Mishpatim has a mitzvah of milk and meat in it. Do we maybe miss the mark? Was this supposed to be in the parsha of chukas instead of Parshas Mishpatim? And that's the question that I've asked. What really is going on over here? Page Kufnun Ches, Simon Lamed, Kufnun Hey, pardon me, Simon Lamed Hey, that I've asked this exact question. Why is it that when it comes to a parsha, we insert a mitzvah, she'ein lo hezber sichli, a mitzvah which really doesn't have an understanding? The Rambam defines the idea of a chok in the end of the laws of Me'ilah. And he says, and I quote, you can see it in the bottom of the page, written on the bottom, Hachukim heina mitzvahs she'ein tamim yudua. He doesn't say the mitzvahs, the chukim are mitzvahs that make no sense. He says the chukim are mitzvahs whose reasons we don't know. Everything has a reason. But these are reasons we don't know. And he says, what's an example of a mitzvah of a reason we don't know? What's an example? Kigoin, for example, Isser B'sar Chazer, the prohibition of eating pig, eating the pig, eating the pork. But this is eating a cow and eating a pig. They're both animals. Ubasar b'chalav. The Rambam says in Hilchas Me'ilah, the Rambam says that the example of a mitzvah, which is considered to be a chok, meaning she'ein tam on yadua, that the reason is not known, what's that mitzvah? The mitzvah is the milk and meat. And here we are with a reason for milk and meat. V'yashleimar, the Rebbe says, this is a possible explanation. Shebekach ba'akosov, the Torah specifically wanted to insert this mitzvah in the middle of a parsha called Rhyme, Reason, and Mishpatim. And that is to teach you. Shegam oisan ha-mitzvahs she'mibchinas chukim. That even the mitzvahs which we don't really understand, mitzvahs which we cannot comprehend necessarily or whose reasons are not known to us, nonetheless, yesh lehisyaches aleihem gam kimishpatim. We should treat them as rational as well. Ula nasais, what does it mean to treat it as rational? To attempt lahavenes tamam, to understand its reasoning kechol haefsher, as much as possible. Uchedivrei Rambam, like the words of the same Rambam, and this is the end of Hilchas Tmura. Afal pi shekol chuki atera gzeres hein, even though all of the Torah's chukim are decrees, meaning God said so, that's why we do it. So why do you do it? Because God said so, and that's a chok. Says Rambam, nonetheless, royally his bainin bahen, it would be appropriate for us to contemplate them. V'chol ma sha'ata yochalite leitam, whatever rhyme or reason you can figure out, any kind of understanding you can attach to it, ten leitam, says Rambam. Excellent, and give it a reason. And our sages did, our rabbis did. Cruelty, blood, idolatry, all the reasons, different reasons that the Shainim gave us. Why is that though? Why? Why should we give it a reason? So the Rebbe suggests that the reason for that reason is as follows. Kasher adam meivin es hasiba lases davar mesuyim. When you understand the reason for doing something, how do you do it?
Better.
You do better. You do it with a sense of fervor, passion, excitement, exuberance. You identify. Hu eisez zeis miteva advar b'yesachayis. Do it with more life, more vitality. There's a lot, there's a tainug, there's a passion. There's even a delight. You enjoy what you're doing. Why? Because you understand it. But when you do not understand the reason why you're doing it, you do it out of obedience, dry obedience. I have no choice. I'll do it. What does the Eibishter want from us? What does God want from us? Does he want us simply to bow our heads in submission and say, fine, God, I don't understand this. I hate it. I'll do it anyway? Mitzvah, the fulfillment of a mitzvah, regardless of whether it's chukim, mishpatim, or eidus, any kind of mitzvah, yichlo shtei hamailos gam yachad. It should have both virtues. L'shem kach leshleis b'inim b'tam mishal chukim. Therefore, we should be contemplating and trying to come up with rhyme, reason, and rationale for mitzvahs whose reasons are really not revealed. Why? Because those mitzvahs also, tzugezunt, have to be done with a sense of joy. A sense of, I identify with this. I relate to this. It'll be with chiyus and oinig, with life and with pleasure. Well, the idach, conversely, yesh lizker. We have to remember also that when we're sitting in the middle of Parshas Mishpatim and talking about mitzvahs whose rhyme and reason is clear, makes absolute sense. You harm somebody, you must make indemnification. It makes sense. And yet, we should do this not because it makes sense, but we should ultimately do it because it's Ritzoynesh LaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's the will of Hashem. And both are necessary. And that's why the Torah made sure to insert in the middle of a parsha that talks about rhyme and reason, a mitzvah which is in many ways transcendent of rhyme and reason, for which we seek rhyme and reason to ultimately create a full synergy and balance. Every mitzvah should be done with fervor, and every mitzvah should be done with a sense of bittul, of humility, and inner obedience before our Kodesh Baruch Hu. That's the Torah meetup for today.